Aboriginal Solidarity Day is annually held on June 21st to celebrate the unique heritage of Canada's Aboriginal peoples. The day provides First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people an opportunity to showcase their cultures and achievements at events across the country. 94.9 CHRW will be celebrating the day by opening the airwaves to a variety of London and campus groups. Aboriginal Solidarity Day will air from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. on 94.9 CHRW and worldwide at chrwradio.com/listen. The broadcast will combine live in-studio programming with pre-recorded items as well as coverage live from London's Celebration in Harris Park. Programming will consist of music-based programs and issues-based talk shows. The day promises to be entertaining, informative, and fast-paced. Join us for Aboriginal Solidarity Day, Monday, June 21st, only on 94.9 CHRW.
Welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce, and this is a special day here at the radio station. This is Aboriginal Solidarity Day. And all day you're going to hear various different things from Harris Park, music, spoken word, etc. So that's our topic for today. We have some special guests. We have Laura Spiro from SOHAC and Nikki George and Doug George from SOHAC, and we've got Luke from Oneida Thames coming on the line shortly. So with all that coming up, and always remember, Between the Margins is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after.
The American continents have been called the New World, but our histories as the original peoples of these lands tell us we have always been here, that we belong to these places which are sacred to us. Our collective memories go far back beyond what the modern world considers history. We have shared these continents in all the four directions for many thousands of years. To us, this is the Old World, and there have been many nations here through the ages. Each of our nations has always had their own ways of life, with distinct beliefs and languages, economic, political, and social systems, and medicinal, ecological, and other forms of knowledge. Every one of these nations has its own way to recognize its place in the greater hoop that we are all part of. And all our diverse forms of knowledge lead back to that common circle. Through our various traditions, we recognize that everything in the universe is connected, that everything has being and deserves respect. We never worship the sun or animals or other forms of nature as gods, but we recognize that these things are symbols of mysteries that cannot be explained in words, and that they all lead back to the greatest mystery of all, the source of all creation. So through our stories and songs, we have always recognized the same ultimate creative force. Some of our elders still remember and maintain the foundations of our original knowledge. We believe that these forms of knowledge can help address urgent matters for the world today.
And we're back, and we're having trouble reaching one of our guests, Luke, so hopefully we'll get in touch with him shortly. But this is Aboriginal Solidarity Day, and, you know, I'm a diversity trainer. As I've spoken many times on the show before about that, and I use First Peoples concepts when I'm out doing various training with, you know, corporations and everything else. So, you know, and it doesn't matter what topic I'm talking about. It doesn't matter if I'm talking about disabled rights, if I'm talking about, you know, sexual orientation or gender identity or sexism, women's rights. It doesn't matter which of these topics I am dealing with, I always use the term happily ever after. And, you know, we talk about happily ever after and how that concept is something that is very personal and unique to every individual on the planet. And, you know, it doesn't matter who you are or what, you know, your personal happily ever after is, somebody else probably doesn't understand it. But if you're getting in the way of somebody else's happily ever after, you're probably violating some human rights code. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about Aboriginal issues and First Peoples rights. And if you're getting in the way of their way of life and getting in the way of their ability to live happily ever after, you're probably violating the human rights code. So we're going to talk a little bit about First Peoples and their journey and, you know, some of the differences between the Western civilization, and we're going to talk about a little bit about, you know, the old ways. And we're also going to talk about some of the health issues. And Sohak has graciously come on board and talked to us about a few of those. But here's a clip from what community this one. They'll introduce themselves.
In Pekani society, an elder is somebody who has looked after a bundle that helped the community and who has passed on that bundle and become a ceremonial grandparent. The ceremonial grandparent can be called back to conduct or oversee ceremonies. And you look to them for guidance and consult with them. We asked our elders about how to communicate between a white man's world and an Indian's world. Because the world we live in today has so much confusion, and this causes a lack of communication, which leads to conflict. We wanted to look at how we view the world from our Pekani belief systems, those forms of knowledge that have been in place for thousands of years. So we asked our elders, who are we as Indian thinkers? Our creation stories, what do they say? And a lot of our stories said that humans were created as equal to all creation. And the concept of being equal defined our thinking and understanding. So I was equal to the animals and plants, the air and the water. The stars were equal to me, and I was equal to all human beings, and even to bugs. Now, the concept of being created equally was the basis of all our practices, our forms of governance, and social relations. We are all created together, and all are sacred. So our Pekani Blackfoot language and oral system are based in ceremonial practices. A ceremonial circle structure was our way of communicating and working in a group. Then we asked our elders, what is a white man thinker? And they recalled the saying, God gives dominion to man. We were taught in residential school that this dominion gives man the right to be superior over all creation, over the plants, animals, rocks, even the skies. This type of thinking was new to our elders, because if you're superior to everything, then the power to make decisions and build credibility is given to man. It's not in Creator's hands anymore. The word dominion used to appear on all the government documents. Every document the Indian agent gave out had Dominion of Canada written on it. So we had to learn a new language based on the idea of the superiority of man. And authority was now held in written documents rather than rites transferred through song and ceremony. And we look to documents for authority today. We ask, what kind of paper does he have? This defines leadership now. The products owned and acquired through dominion, authorized by the written word, and controlled by a hierarchy that places man at the top of all creation. All these concepts were embedded in the white man's education, government, and religion. And today, we have to operate within that perspective. This creates challenges for us in passing on traditional Pekani knowledge to our children. If we're going to keep our culture alive, we need to involve our elders and ceremonial grandparents in our operations. So we took the circle model that our elders had and started working with that, looking at how to interpret that so we can use it today. For example, when we discuss things or make decisions, the topic is like a sacred bundle. It should be opened respectfully and understood with care as deeply as possible. We still have a smudge altar, which is parallel to the gavel used in modern boardrooms to start meetings. And we still need our elders at the door to advise and watch over us and help us to respectfully manage our process. These are just a few examples of how we have been adapting our circle model and the knowledge of our elders to the modern world.
Okay, we're back, and I have Luke Nicholas, who is from the Oneida First Nations, on the line. Hi, Luke.
Good morning, Michelle.
Glad to have you on this, important day on our annual calendar, Aboriginal Solidarity Day.
Thank you.
Are you doing anything special today?
Well, I'm heading down to Harris Park, and then there are going to be some activities this evening at Oneida Nation of the Thames. I think they're going to have some fireworks and a few bands going, and it's all supposed to start around 6 o'clock.
Yes. I'm on my way after the show down there myself to take in the celebrations. Now, you and I were talking a little bit earlier, and we just played a couple of clips about Western world versus, old traditional ways of First Peoples and everything else. Maybe you can answer me a question. I've always been curious, why do we call it the Western world?
Well, I guess that it could be explained in a number of different ways, but I mean, like, it is, again, the ideologies that of the two different worlds and the worldview. Today, the Solidarity Day is not only about beyond the celebration and the recognition of Canada's First Nations and Aboriginal people. It is greatly about their philosophy, our worldview, how we see things, how we understand things, how we connect, and how we relate to the world. And this is something that is entrenched very deeply in how Canada operates. Our understanding of democracy, our ability to assemble, our freedom of speech, those are all things that found their roots and their origins in the First Nations, in First Nations people. And so for those early settlers, those early colonizers that came here, and they talked about this idea of freedom and their liberation from the monarchy and from the government. This was the first time that they got to taste and feel that freedom and to know what it's like to be free. And so, when you think about the things that we do have in the Western world, the freedoms that we have, that we talk about, the ability to be socially mobile, all of those things come, they draw right back to these ideas that people are created equal, that people have the right to speak, that people have the rights to pursue happiness. Those ideologies come straight back to my ancestors, to the First Peoples of Turtle Island.
Since you mentioned that Turtle Island, maybe you can tell us what Turtle Island is.
Okay. Well, it's
I know there's a long story that goes with it, and it's a fascinating story.
There's a long story, and it takes a few days to tell, but for our purposes, we'll keep it brief. Many First Peoples of North America found their drawback to their time of beginning, their time of memorial, their creation story, how everything began, to that life begin on the back of a turtle. And, in for my people, my ancestors believed that a woman fell from the sky and that she landed on this great turtle's back, and that the animals, the early animals of Earth, helped her in the beginning, and there are all kinds of stories about how the Earth kind of came to be. And that's where you kind of find this notion of Turtle Island, or you hear a lot of people saying Mother the Earth, and it's not something that's just First Nations that say it. It's commonly said by many, many, many people, both here in Canada, the United States, and all over the world. That concept, Mother the Earth, comes from those stories. Comes from the stories of the first people, from my ancestors that believed that the woman that fell from the sky, that she gave birth to a daughter, and this daughter became very important to us, because when she was buried, from her grew all life, and on this turtle's back, and that's how we come to understand, and that's how we come to know who Mother Earth is. So these concepts that we talk about, like Mother of the Earth, that are shared now by countless thousands of people around the world, those are concepts that draw their origins again back to the stories of our people, the first peoples of this land.
I'll call myself a rookie on first peoples issues, because I will tell you, I grew up in an extremely racist environment. My childhood is filled with bigotry and concepts that are embarrassing to me today. And through the years, you know, once at 16, I got out of my family life and I moved out on my own, and I started developing my own viewpoint on the world and my own views, which have, you know, brought me to this place where I'm a huge advocate, and I spend, you know, 80 hours a week advocating for the rights of minority groups. But, you know, it was a journey for me, and it's a journey that a lot of people went. And in that journey, I had to come to terms with, you know, first peoples and the battles. And, you know, I always grew up with people telling me, well, you know, the Indians lost the war, and, you know, and now we stuck them on reservations, where, you know, in my childhood, I brought up views of concentration camps, and, you know, that's how my childhood was brought up, which is so far from the truth that, I mean, it's totally ironic. So when we talk about, you know, the way people and first peoples make decisions, and we talked about the sustainability of culture and the sustainability of, you know, first people's way of doing things, which is extremely healthy for the planet, and, you know, it's green and all of the things that we work for. Can you talk about that sustainability?
Sure, absolutely. You raised a point that I wanted to speak to.
It
was about this notion, and you hear this often too, the First Nations lost a war, or we beat them, and they should give it up, and they should stop fighting, and blocking roads, and doing all of these things, they should stop defending their rights, because they don't have any. And, you know, I'm not entirely sure, but I'd like somebody to reference that war, because in my understanding, and that there has never been a war that I understand where the Indians lost. We have to understand that that in Canada, treaties were written between the settler governments and the First Nations. And treaties are, you know, these international agreements that we make from one nation to another. And we don't often make treaties with people that we conquer or we subjugate. And so in this case, I have trouble understanding, well, what war did we lose? There are agreements in place. Our people have never lost in a war. We've never surrendered our land, and we've never been conquered by the number of tests that are out there. Um, so so, you know, we have to be clear when we talk about that, and we have to be able to inform others about that when we hear this kind of discussion going on, the Indians lost. Well, what did we lose exactly? And I'd like to hear a reference to that, you know, in my discussion. And I come across this all the time. I mean, my work and the things that I do for a living, I work with institutions and governments and the private sector, and there's all kinds of misinformation about the history of First Peoples here. And part of, you know, and I, like you, believe that I don't know a whole lot about it. I'm not a big I'm just learning. I need to understand more. I know just a piece of the iceberg in terms of the knowledge and the information on the history and the origins of all of this. So I believe that it's necessary for people that have the information, the knowledge, to go out there and act as beacons on these issues, to educate those people who, you know, to know more about this. And then on the second point around this idea of sustainability and our special, this notion of sustainability is that many of the practices that we have in our contemporary society, you know, which is motivated by media and consumerism, and is that we need to use more. We need to destroy everything. I mean, like, I guess our idea is not that we need to destroy everything, but our notions and our values that we hold so deeply take us to that place where we have to destroy everything. And so, you know, if you look at my ancestors' beliefs, and some of the and the beliefs that many of my people hold today, you know, you see it rooted in their governance systems. You see it rooted in their way of life. You see it rooted in the teachings, and a lot of it is around this notion of sustainability, that we cannot use more. We have to remember to give back, and this is deeply rooted in this this belief that we are connected to the earth, that we are connected to all living things, and that we have no more rights as human beings than any other creature on the planet. And so, you know, when you look at the institutions of government, of governance within the First Nations and the Aboriginal circles, you know, when they speak, and for my ancestors, we call this, and for my people, we call it the seven-generation system. That's how we designed our decision-making process as we look forward. And seven generations, and we talk about this with our chiefs and our clan mothers, we say, you know, that the decisions that you make today are the decisions that are based on seven generations from now, that we'll never see that seventh generation. You and I will never see who those children are, but eventually they will be here. Eventually they will walk the earth, and they will, you know, they will be allowed to participate in the gift that we've been given called life, and that in this way, that today we have to make decisions for that seventh generation, that how we conduct ourselves today, whether it be how we grow our food or how we develop our relationships with ourselves and our neighbors and our families, like that, all has to do with making those decisions for a better tomorrow. So that's exactly the kind of philosophies that are entrenched. The governments of today, you know, their mandates run out in 3 or 4 years. You know, they have a set of values, and they try to stay in power for as long as possible. But if it doesn't work, then somebody else takes the reins. And so it's not deeply entrenched within their system, within their governance system, within their decision-making system to say, you know, we have to look out for our future generations.
Exactly. And, you know, just to, when we talk about that education package and learning these concepts, and, you know, I'm a very beginner on that, but I credit turning me from that bigoted youth to a more mature adult who is educated on these issues and blow those stereotypes out of the water and actually start me on a path of truth was, Shannon Thunderbird. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her, but, you know, she gave a presentation at a conference that I was at and, you know, started teaching me, you know, the way of First Peoples from the truth. And, you know, I credit her for changing my viewpoints on these issues. Are you familiar with her?
No, I'm not, actually.
Yeah. She goes around to schools and does teaching and tells stories. And you know, that's where I first learned about Turtle Island and heard those stories, which fascinated me. And I learned about, you know, circles and elder circles and decision-making processes where people sit around the circle to make a decision and use I statements and I believe that this is the way it should be. And then the next person says how they believe how it should be and around it goes until the I statements come to consensus, no matter how long it takes. And nobody short-circuits the circle by saying you should believe, which really hit home to me.
I've met a lot of people in my work and personally and professionally and from different walks of life. And for many people, I believe this holds to be true. They find a natural attraction to the, our way to the Hungwe Hungwe. And the Hungwe Hungwe is, the word that my people use to describe ourselves, and it's that natural way, and that's a reason why a lot of people are attracted to it, because it's so natural. It's deeply rooted in the natural world about how the conflict of creatures and beast and plant life and all of that other stuff. This is the natural way. And so for many of those who hear those stories, who hear about the plight that many of the First Nations people are up against today, they themselves in the world surrounding us feel controlled by our governments. We feel a certain degree of apathy because of the current political climate. What can people do? How can we affect change? And when you hear stories about the trials and the tribulations and the fight that's out there that we're representing, that this is the natural way, then people are drawn to it. People have a natural inkling to do it. There's something in their blood, because all of those natural teachings, they came to all the peoples of the earth. All peoples encompassed them in their origins at some point in time. Some people have taken a different path. Some people have gone off of that path, and they've decided to follow something unnatural. And so what we see around us today, this is unnatural. We build buildings and we demolish forests in the name of progress, and we call that progress. And this is unnatural, and we feel a little uneasy. And collectively, we all feel a little uneasy today. We're concerned because there's typhoons and hurricanes and a world water shortage. There are things going on, the oil spill in the Gulf, and you know, there are things going on that we feel very uneasy about, and so we cannot be hitting in the right way. It's logic that we cannot be hitting in the right way. Global warming, all of those issues that we have that we're facing as a society, as global citizens. There is a natural attraction to find ways to not work against Mother the Earth, but to work with her, to work within the system. And those systems are natural, and they come from the indigenous people all over the world.
Which are the things that we teach our children. I mean, our kids go to kindergarten, and we teach them that they can't hog the toys, that they're there for all to use, and no one person owns those toys, and you can't take them home, and you have to share, and you have to be a part of the community and work together towards... I mean, these are all concepts that come from First Peoples, you know, ways, correct?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. They come from, you know, they come from indigenous people all over the world that have this idea that we're all in this together. You know, human beings are like no other creature on the planet. We don't have fur. We don't have, you know, to protect us from the cold. We don't have sharp teeth. We don't have claws to defend ourselves. We just have this huge thalamus, this different piece of our brain that grows. And in that part, you know, and these different parts of our brain, they teach us how to that we need one another as human beings. That we need to work together. That's our only defense as human beings. At least it used to be in the natural world, is that we had a need for one another, and so we employed these communal type lifestyles. You know, where we had to learn together, work together, be together, support one another, encourage one another, and recognize that that no one was more than anyone else. And so in that way, you know, you go to a daycare on Oneida, for example, one of the first things that they learn, and these are infants and toddlers and preschoolers, you know, so anybody from zero to the age of five. And one of the first things that they learn there at Oneida is Ganahila Dungsla. And those are the words that are said before all else. And that's known as the Thanksgiving address. And the whole process is giving thanks to every, spirit and organism and living thing that we understand, the trees, our grandmother, the moon, our mother, the earth, the water, the birds, the insects, the winged animals, the stars, to the beings in the sky that watch over us. Those are all things that we acknowledge, and we start to teach our children these things because it's necessary that as they get older, as they move forward through life, that, you know, we ask ourselves, you know, often this question comes up, how do we prepare for the seventh generation? What do we do today? It sounds like a really romantic concept. Everybody likes it. It's a good thing. But how do we do it exactly? What are the practical applications? Well, there it is right there. Teach children how to respect one another. Teach children how to be tolerant of one another. Teach them to give thanks for all of the wonderful things that they have in their lives. And only then will you start to see a change. Then will you start to see how differently we treat one another. There was a study that came out not too long ago, right here in Canada, and traditionally in Canada, culture stayed within their own culture to procreate and to marry and to have relationships. And that's changing. That's changing significantly, that more people are choosing other people from different cultures to spend their lives with, to build a life with, to partner and to have children with. And so, you know, this is a significant thing. I believe a good thing, because it's going to help us, you know, learn how to live with one another, to be different. We're all so extremely different. And how do we live together? How do we mold ourselves so that we're one unit, so that we work together, encourage one another, love one another as families and friends? And that's the basis. The family is the basis for how we form that. And it's true. Much of that is found in indigenous peoples all over the world, in many different families all over the world. But the question is, how do we get our folks who are the decision makers, who are the politicians. How do we get them to incorporate those values?
Well,
how do we get them to make decisions that are not only that are going to last 4 years or for the duration of their mandate?
I think education is the key to that. And unfortunately, we're out of time, Luke, and I could talk to you all day. And I actually encourage you to stop by the CHRW booth at Terrace Park and stop in and talk more on the radio today and with all of the folks there. And I'm sure they would welcome you to continue talking about some of these extremely important issues where we need to start working together on this planet instead of against each other. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle. And I just want to say, you know, happy Solidarity Day to everyone out there, to my people, but also to the non-Aboriginal people. If you don't partake in the celebration today, then, you know, I challenge you and to commit to learning one thing about Canada's First Nations and Indigenous people.
Great. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Aboriginal Solidarity Day is annually held on June 21st to celebrate the unique heritage of Canada's Aboriginal peoples. The day provides First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people an opportunity to showcase their cultures and achievements at events across the country. 94.9 CHRW will be celebrating the day by opening the airwaves to a variety of London and campus groups. Aboriginal Solidarity Day will air from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. on 94.9 CHRW and worldwide at chrwradio.com/listen. The broadcast will combine live in-studio programming with pre-recorded items as well as coverage live from London's Celebration and Harris Park. Programming will consist of music-based programs and issues-based talk shows. The day promises to be entertaining, informative, and fast-paced. Join us for Aboriginal Solidarity Day, Monday, June 21st, only on 94.9 CHRW.
Hi there, and we are live from...
We'll take your questions.
Back live from Harris Park.
Hey, bonjour, everybody. We're down here at Harris Park, and it's a beautiful day. We want you all to come down here. We have some free stuff for you, some free CHRW pins, and some free tattoos. So come on down and see Michael Brown.
Yeah, hello, ami, bonjour, sego, me, wache, colomoste. Greetings to all of your listeners of CHRW 94.9 FM. My name is Dan Smoke. Asaninas Berlu. You introduce yourself, your surname?
Asaninas Clay and Desnakar. Makwai Bodam. That's one of Dunchba. My spirit name is Shitty Star Woman. I'm Bear Clan and originally called from Batchewanabe, Ontario.
Yes, we are Smoke Signals, First Nations Radio, and CHRW. We are often heard on Sunday nights from 6:30 to 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, www.chrwradio.com. Yes, we've been asked to talk a little bit about the day today. Our children, our gifts is the theme down here at Harris Park. I want to say Jimmy Glenciniella to those of you at the station who are manning the controls and letting us do this cut-in. We've just finished the grand entry. The invocation is now taking place with Liz Akwenzi, and she's sharing prayer and words that to express our gratitude for this beautiful day, this beautiful Wanish Leo day that we've been blessed with down here. I would say we have about 30 vendors, 40 vendors here in total, selling everything from crafts, food. There's even an elder's tent. There's different agencies who are set up here, the Namarin Friendship Center, Southwestern Ontario Aboriginal Health Access Center. There is a, the main stage of the gazebo is manned by volunteers who are going to be cooking for the day. They're cooking the lunch meal, barbecuing hamburgers and hot dogs free for everybody. So they will soon be handing them out. So everyone, you can feel the excitement building in the air, right, Mario?
Yeah.
So, okay, the MC has just announced that they're going to be beginning the actual powwow. There's two drums here right now, Eagle Flight and the Nahi Singers. So there's two drums that are present here for today. I think they'll be here for the duration for the rest of the afternoon. And there's about maybe 10 dancers and about three flag carriers. Sam Hearns. Sam Hearns is a war veteran. He is carrying the Eagle Staff, his own Eagle Staff that he carries as a veteran. And he, I know that he's been carrying that Eagle Staff since 1990s.
Yes, for a long time.
Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, and there's a couple of teepees down here. So for anyone out of you out there in the public that would like to come down here and join us on Aboriginal Solidarity Day, we encourage you to come on down. It's a free public event. You're going to be learning a lot. Just come down and, you know, share with each one of the vendors and traders that are here. Just talk to them, you know, and ask them, you know, questions that you might have that pique your interest. But I would like to explain to you the origin of Aboriginal history. Aboriginal Solidarity Day, National Aboriginal Day, as it's commonly known in House of Commons parlance. In 1982, the National Indian Brotherhood, who were the predecessor of the Assembly of First Nations, passed a motion that said that basically we should not be celebrating Queen Victoria Day, which is the May 2-4 weekend, that we should be in turn be celebrating our own day, a day of significance for us, which would be June 21st. That was the day that they selected because June 21st was the longest day of the year. It's a day when the summer equinox arrives. It arrived at 7:28 this morning. And it's a day that in many of our indigenous people's cultures, we come together and we celebrate our culture and our identity. And it's also known as a day to, I'm not, you know, there's no particular ceremony set for this day, but it was just a day that they picked, June 21st. So June 21st is the day that we have been celebrating it ourselves. Mary Lou and I have been organizing Solidarity Day events since 1990. From 1990 to 1995, we took it upon ourselves to organize a sunrise ceremony, teaching workshops, having some people come and speak for the morning, and then if we had enough interest, we would have people go right through the lunch hour and into the afternoon, and then we would pretty much close up for the rest of the day. Because at that time, there wasn't that much interest. There wasn't that much interest in the participation in Aboriginal Solidarity Day because it wasn't formally recognized by our people. But Mary Lou and I, we remembered that 1982, the National Indian Brotherhood said that this is something that we should do, create our own, have our own culture-based day of recognition of our contributions to the world and recognize it and celebrate it. And have a festival to do that, in which to do it. So this is how National Aboriginal Solidarity Day began, with our understanding. And then in 1990 happened. July the 11th, 1990, the SQ came in and started firing live ammunition at women and children at Ganasapage, a Ganyangehaga community, a Mohawk community in Quebec. Place called Oka, Quebec. And when they fired upon these defenseless women and children, that began the protracted, drawn-out standoff between the Indigenous peoples of this land and the federal Canadian government, so who sent them the army. And for 78 days was an armed standoff, which resolved itself in a good way, with the Indigenous peoples coming out, and three of whom were arrested and convicted of charges of assault and several other trumped up charges. I think they all did time, but the people that were in there, people like my friend, my brother, my mentor, Bruce Elijah, who were in there, were helping the people to stay together, stay united. So anyways, that happened July 11th, 1990. So this July the 11th, 2010, will be the 20-year anniversary. And right here in London, 1991, July the 11th, 1991, we planted a tree, a white pine, known as the Tree of Peace. We planted it right next to the Peace Garden. It's still growing there. It's about 30 feet tall now. And when we grew it, when we planted it, it was just a small little tree, about 2 feet high, and it didn't even look like it was going to survive. It was all squiggly. It was all crooked. But today, it's just a tall, magnificent-looking white pine sitting next to the Peace Garden over in Ivy Park. So that's on July the 11th, we are going to celebrate the 20-year anniversary of OCA. So come on out for that. We will be gathering and forming a prayer circle. So we'd like to invite you to come out for that, that prayer circle. So that's going to be happening on July the 11th. Now, what happened then after July the 11th, 1990, was the Royal Commission was called by the then Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney, and the Royal Commission recommended that there be a day set aside for First Nations people to celebrate their culture, their identity, and their contributions that they made to the rest of the country. And so the rest of the country should recognize that day. And that day was the day that they selected was June 21st, the same day as our National Native Brotherhood motion. So June 21st, every June 21st, we have been celebrating that day. In fact, after the Royal Commission came out in 1996 and proclaimed June 21st as the National Aboriginal Day by the Governor General of the day, Romeo LeBlanc, then we had this day set aside for us to come together. And ever since then, we have been doing that. Now, it's interesting for the public to know, because the public has been joining us over the years, because we celebrated either at Harris Park down here next to the Thames River, or we celebrated up at Victoria Park, which is right across the road from the City Hall. So either place has been going back and forth from both places to celebrate and to come together in a good way to acknowledge the first original peoples of this land. And we're always glad to see our non-Native brothers and sisters here, because that shows that they're interested in understanding and learning about the original history of this land. And it's always good to see. Hey, Meredith?
Sure is, Dan. People are so proud about our heritage and our culture. And when we have an opportunity to gather like this, people just jump at the opportunity to come out and celebrate.
Yes. And this is the first time that CHRW has come together to put our collective efforts to hear the voices of our nations, because we are many varied nations down here. We're not just the Algonquian language family and the Haudenosaunee language family. We are many nations here. I was just speaking to a girl, a lady who comes from Saskatchewan. She's Cree. And she speaks her language, the Cree language, which is part of the Algonquian language family. So we have all these different, varied nations, backgrounds of people here, down here at the park right now. And you never know who you're going to, when you're talking to people, you never know where they come from unless you ask them. So don't be afraid to ask them what their background is. You know, it's not an insult to ask, where you're from. Now, where are you from? And usually you get the answer, well, I'm Anishinaabe, and my clan is the Bear Clan, and I come from Matawana Bay, 40 miles north of St. Marie. You know, that would be a common, typical answer. But people will always announce who they come from, where they come from, who their people are, what nations that their parents come from. And for the Ojibwe Anishinaabe people, from the Algonquin Lake family people, their lineage comes from their father. For the Haudenosaunee Iroquois people, their lineage comes from their mother's side. So I take on the same lineage as my mother, who is a Seneca woman, a member of the Kildare clan. So I'm a member of the Seneca Kildare clan people. And so that's the way we distinguish, you know, each other and our backgrounds. And we always acknowledge where we come from. We always try to acknowledge who our people are. So you'll hear that when you come down here. But come on down and join us down here in the park. We're glad to be here. Right now, Mary Lou and I, we are going to be heading back up to the London Convention Center, where the Law Society of Upper Canada is having their convocation of lawyers, new lawyers who have been studying lost school for 3 or 4 years, probably 4 years, and then they have to take their bar, not their bar admission, their law exams, and then they have to article for a year, and then when they finish their articling, then they're called to the bar. And they go through this ceremony that makes them a full-fledged lawyer. They now become lawyers after today because this is like their convocation. So every year, which is really beautiful, every year we always graduate at least 2 or 3 indigenous lawyers. So that means more and more of our people are becoming educated in terms of the law, readying themselves for a law career, legal career, and they're graduating. And so Mary Lou and I, we go down there to help them graduate, to help them with the convocation. We sit there with the Law Society of Upper Canada bench, the law school, the Law Society of Upper Canada bench, and we sit with them, and we congratulate the Aboriginal lawyers being called to the bar through the ceremony. So we're going to be heading over there now. We'll be coming back here to be on the air for cut-ins with whoever's at CHRW. Probably Kim's probably going to be one of the people that will be up there. And I believe that John Urban is scheduled for later on today. So thank you, Yahweh, Chimigwech, Tupwe, Willalin, Pilamea, for letting us do this cut-in and educating the public about Aboriginal Solidarity Day and why we do it and why we gather here every June 21st.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, on up.
Michelle, back to you.
And we're back to Between the Margins. And we're back with Between the Margins here on CHRW 94.9 FM. And I'm Michelle Boyce, and Between the Margins is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after, which you can find a lot of happily ever after happening down in Harris Park today. So come on down and join us at the CHRW booth and have a lot of fun there. They've got free prizes and giveaways and things like that. And, of course, enjoy the Aboriginal Solidarity Day there. So with Between the Margins, we've got an interview with Laura Spiro from SOHAC talking about a very important issue with her.
It started out as a very traditional center, but now it's become more westernized based on, you know, the needs of the population. I do mostly fetal alcohol awareness and prevention programming as it pertains to, you know, the Aboriginal population in and around the London area. Well, what I do specifically is I do healthy lifestyle programming and talk about, you know, drinking during pregnancy and the ramifications it has on the unborn baby. So I do mostly prevention, but because I've been in this role for six years, going on 7 years, I'm finding that most people now are understanding what the problems are as they're associated to drinking during pregnancy, and now it's more or less what supports are out there, what types of programs do you offer, where can children who are affected, where can they get services, which, of course, I can honestly speak for Ontario that there aren't a whole lot of services specifically for those who have an alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disability. So I'm seeing kind of a shift in what the needs of the population are. So it's not necessarily prevention. So right now I'm finding my position is kind of changing. I'm doing a lot of advocacy. So it's really interesting. And then I travel across the country and bring back current research to our doctors and mental health workers and psychologists here at the center, so that they're kept abreast of all the current stuff that's going down as it relates to fetal alcohol. So it's really super interesting. I mean, there's never a dull moment. Unfortunately, you know, it just seems that the funding always seems to come from Aboriginal pots of money, which kind of puts the message out that fetal alcohol is an Aboriginal issue, and it couldn't be farther from the truth. If there's any message that gets put out there, it's like anybody, any woman who's able to drink is quite capable of you know, having a baby that's affected, because a lot of times women don't even know they're pregnant. So, you know, and there is a stigma attached to it, and the really interesting part of my job at the beginning was trying to relinquish that stigma, because, you know, even doctors in London, they really struggle with the notion of giving that child that label, and they don't want to do that because they think that once the child is labeled with an FASD, then the mother is automatically labeled as an alcoholic. And it's, you know, we need to educate everybody that that's not the case at all, that, you know, it's very common, and we need to embrace it and just realize that, you know, these children have strengths too, and if we can look at it from a strength-based model and focus on what they can do rather than what they can't do, then, you know, I think we would all be a lot better off. But it's really trying to overcome the stigma and embracing the fact that this is a social issue, and it's not just a women's issue, that when we talk about, you know, family planning, it starts from the very beginning. You know, when you want to start planning a family, you have to consider, you know, let's not use drugs, let's not use alcohol. Even if we're contemplating starting a family, we need to just get rid of it all, you know. But in a perfect world, I guess that would be great. But we don't live in a perfect world, so we have to consider, you know, so it might happen, you're going to have a baby. Yes, you drank during the first trimester, you didn't realize you were pregnant, but let's move beyond and understand. And, you know, I think that's where we need to be. And, you know, with Ontario, I think British Columbia is far more advanced than Ontario is, but from a provincial standpoint, I think Ontario's coming along. I mean, we've got an identified stakeholders group for the province, and we also have an interministerial group, which is, I'm just trying to think of the acronym, it's FIANO, and it stands for Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Interagency Action Networking Group for the government. So
that's helpful.
It is, and they're just, you know, coming together as a government, and there are certain people from each ministry that come together to talk about FASD and where the government is. And so, you know, we're really hoping that we can come up with some sort of a provincial framework, you know, some sort of a strategy, because right now there isn't a ministry that has it on board. Our funding for SOHAC's FASD program is funded through the Ministry of Child and Youth Service. And we're refunded every 5 years, so it's not like it's an everlasting program. So every 5 years, you know, we're sitting on pins and needles wondering if we're going to get refunded again. So, you know, it's a very interesting position. There's a lot of work that can be done. Things are always changing. So I'm really, you know, it's been really exciting.
What kind of cultural challenges do you face working within your communities versus, you know, other workers that work within other communities?
Well, because we work with the 7 Aboriginal communities in and around London, so we often go into the communities, and I choose the word communities rather than reservations, only because it just seems to be, there seems to be some problems sometimes around the terminologies. So when I talk about communities, I'm talking about, you know, the Kettle and Stony Point Reservation, Chippewa Sarnia Reservation. So when we go into the different communities, I think that, you know, sometimes we're dealing with issues of, you know, a lot of poverty issues, of intergenerational abuse issues, and sometimes it makes it really difficult to even address when you consider the social determinants of health. You know, a lot of times those aren't even being met. And so to talk about any types of other prevention strategies, it almost makes it null and void because, you know, they're not even meeting their basic needs. So that's a giant hurdle for a lot of programming. You know, it can be really quite challenging.
Must be really challenging dealing with women who are in abusive situations and using alcohol to cope with those situations and then getting pregnant. And that must be a really challenging piece for you to work through.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, yeah, it is. It's extremely challenging, but I'm very determined to educate our communities and, you know, make them realize that when they do see a pregnant woman drinking, the best thing they can do for that woman is just to go over and let's go for a walk or let's go play bingo or just get her away from the booth temporarily, you know, so that that baby has a chance. And, you know, it can be really sad, but, you know, just getting out the word and the education and the awareness is really important.
Well, it sounds like you're doing some amazing work. When we talk about the children, what are some of the challenges that, you know, babies suffering from FASD, what are some of the challenges they face?
Well, because you're considering FAS it is a spectrum. So some of the diagnoses that fall within that spectrum are fetal alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol effects, alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disabilities, and alcohol-related birth defects. Within all those diagnoses, and there are more as well, those are just four of the most common. Of those four diagnoses, I mean, you could be placed anywhere on the spectrum. So to be born with fetal alcohol syndrome, you would be born, obviously your mother would have drinking daily, and she would have, you know, been a really big-time alcoholic. And that baby would most likely never be able to live on its own. It would be a very disabled baby. Children who are born with the full syndrome, you know, would never go to school. They'd probably be born with multiple disabilities ranging from anything from, you know, they're going to have the physical abnormalities, but they're going to also have, you know, kidney damage or liver damage, you know, dental abnormalities, like anything that can happen in utero. And if mom chooses to drink at any time in pregnancy, she's going to do damage to whatever is forming at that particular time. Now, you've also got the consideration, too, that during the entire 9 months of gestation, the brain and central nervous system is forming. So these children are born with abnormalities of the brain, and unfortunately it will never get better. So somebody who's born with the full syndrome has a lot of challenges where it comes to thinking and behaviors, and there are certain characteristics of children who have the syndrome. So they're highly impulsive, they have no sense of consequences, so you know, their impulsivity just takes them to places where, you know, kids don't want to go. The inability to have really meaningful relationships. You know, they are very sporadic in their thinking. People often see them as lying, but they don't lie. It's just they can't retrieve information from their brain how you and I would retrieve the information. So if you were to ask them one question one day, you would get a different answer if you were to ask that question today. So, you know, they're not able to give you, they're not consistent in telling the same story over and over again. And then, of course, you're looking at the opposite end of the spectrum to a child that looks completely normal but has the organic brain dysfunction and has the inability to, you know, to think like normal children would think, and that's all attributed to the alcohol consumption in utero. So these children look very normal, they seem to act very normal, but they are struggling with their thought process. So those kids often are, you know, they're in the school system, and teachers see them as like not, why is this child just not grasping the concepts that other kids are getting? Why is it that they seem to know the concept one day but then not the next? And it all has to do with the organic brain dysfunction. So it's a real struggle to have these kids educated mainstream when they absolutely positively do flourish in a smaller educational setting where they've got the one-on-one with the teacher, you know, they don't have the external stimulus that often poses a lot of problems. These kids really need to be in classrooms with, you know, very little color, you know, not a whole lot of external stimulus, because they just, their brains can't handle it. And so many other things that children with an alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disability, it's pretty much an independent diagnosis, like where they are and what they can handle, because no two people are the same. And, you know, when you consider what alcohol does to a fetus and how people are very different, it makes it very difficult to generalize, you know, with children. So you do have to take it from a very individualistic perspective. And what is it that this child can handle? What is it that this child can't handle? Oftentimes, a secondary diagnosis might be ADHD, attention deficit, hyperactive disorder, or oppositional defiant disorder, reactive attachment disorders. All those types of disorders often go hand in hand with an FASD. So, you know, these kids really have difficult times if they're not diagnosed at an early age. But there is so much information that one needs to understand about children who do have an FASD. I mean, it's very complex, but the diagnosis, to get a diagnosis, is relatively simple. It's all the assessments that are done that take the longest time, because they have to have the psychological testing, even some neuropsychological testing. If they're really problematic, sometimes they'll even go so far as having an MRI, because there is, you can actually see in an MRI that parts of the brain that have been affected. It's really, really interesting.
Well, you fascinated me.
Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I probably went on and on and on and on and on.
No, that's awesome and great. And so, yeah, I've been talking to Laura Spiro from Southwest Ontario Aboriginal Health Access Centre. And thank you so much for talking to me, Laura.
Oh, you're welcome.
My name is Doug George. I'm the program coordinator for the traditional healing programs for Southwest Ontario Aboriginal Health Access Centre, based in London, Ontario, and also on the Chippewas of the Thames First Nation. So HAC is, well, the traditional healing program is actually a unique program to health access centres throughout Ontario, and it's currently funded by the Aboriginal Healing and Wellness Strategy through Ontario, and the province of Ontario anyways. And so what the program does for our particular health access center anyways is it tries to provide services to an Aboriginal population. Aboriginal defined as status, non-status Indians, Métis, and Inuit people in our region, with Indigenous healing services, which includes it can include anything. It's more than just a lot of people have this mindset that just deal with herbs, you know, like they might come in and kind of like a Chinese medicine philosophy type of thing, but actually it deals far more with that. It's dealing with energy based, I should say. It's dealing with the physical, the mental, the emotional, and the spiritual, especially. And so when somebody actually comes in to seek one of the traditional healers, we first try to find out where they're connected to, because in the City of London region, we currently have probably people who represent or come from 21 separate nations of Indigenous people. And so what we have to do is we have to try to match them up with one of our healers who would be able to best complement the style of healing that is conducted within that person's Indigenous culture. It varies widely. So, for example, in around the Great Lakes region, throughout on the province of Ontario, anyways, one of the largest groups of people that we have are the Anishinaabe people. Otherwise, I guess in English, the Anglicized version is Ojibwe or Chippewa. And many of the people there, they would conduct their healing ceremonies in one particular fashion, approach elders in one particular fashion. Quite often, it's the men who do a lot of the speaking in the ceremonies, which gives outsiders the perception. They have this ethnocentric view when they see that the men are in charge, which it's not actually. It's more of a, I would say, an egalitarian approach. So the women are the ones that are actually reminding the men what to say, what to do, and they do that. But they give the men the right to speak and to talk, okay, for everything that goes on. So quite often you'll see that we also have to keep in mind one of the First Nations that's very close to the City of London is the Oneida Nation of the Ten, who is one part of the Six Nations, which include those Six Nations with people in Brantford and also pretty close to Belleville and also up in the Cornwall region. That's Akwesasne and also Montreal, which is the Gosnawaga people. So these ones are from the Haudenosaunee people, and they do things. They conduct ceremonies totally opposite from the Ojibwe people. And they take our clan system. They inherit their clan system from the their mother's side also. And so we have to be very careful on how we actually help the people coming from the Six Nations also, but because they have very specific ceremonies that they have to conduct, and quite often too. So, for example, they have monthly ceremonies, or if they have particular ceremonies that they have to conduct, once they're inducted into those ceremonies, I should say, they have to continue those ceremonies every year for the remainder of their lives, which contribute to some of the illness if they fail to uphold that part of their bargain. And during those ceremonies, what they do is they offer feasts and giveaways, those types of things. And the traditional healers will speak for them on their behalf in these ceremonies and conduct the ceremonies in front of the people, I guess. So there is many, many different aspects that are here. Well, here at Soul Hack, although our traditional healers cannot conduct higher ceremonies, we would call them, they do assist people and take people to other regions where they can actually do those if they're necessary. Quite often we'll have people visit our traditional healers here, and they find themselves in a counselor's role, very, very similar to a mental health counselor. So they hear many, many, many different stories, some of them nice, but most of them very gory stories with regards to violence and prejudice and different things that happen to them in the course of their lives. So they help them and assist them with that, and their healing, steer them in the right direction. They try to get them to see doctors, medical doctors or medical staff. So I guess that's the other thing. A lot of people have a misconception, I guess, that they don't like doctors. Traditional healers that we deal with anyways are view everything is complementary, and they view that they have the ideology that no one culture has all of the answers. And of course they do teach the people natural medicines, different medicines or various medicines that are regional to where their ancestors lived or where they came from. With medical cutbacks, more and more people are seeking the healing, or the different types of various medicines that would actually help them in the process of healing.
Sounds like a pretty huge job with a...
Oh, it is a pretty huge job, and there's only one staff member staffing the entire program, and we can only service so many people. With a traditional healing program, we have people coming here from all of the cities within that region, outside of the region, and also we have people coming from First Nations communities into the city also, because in some of the communities it's just not culturally safe to seek traditional healing services within their health centers that are on reserve, which is that shocks people sometimes.
It shocks me.
Yes, and by culturally, you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean by culturally safe?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, so when they go to their health centers, quite often anything like smudging or use of various types of traditional items is looked down upon, and sometimes complaints actually arise, you know, like when that happens. Then we have people still in the mindset that it's not a good practice, it's evil, it's totally against the Christian faith or Christian beliefs, which is very prevalent within some of the communities. Yeah, so it's a very slow process, and that actually is a part of the healing process within our communities. I guess that's more at the higher social level, where you're dealing with large populations of people, and how do you get to change their belief systems, and how do you get them to accept this is a part of their own culture, their heritage, who they are, and that it's safe and it's good.
And it's complementary to Western medicine.
Yes, it is. It's complementary to Western medicine, and so you have a wheel spinning in the opposite direction that you have to deal with the doctors, of course, because cultural competency and cultural safety are so brand new within many of the primary healthcare systems in the province of Ontario, that we're still dealing, by and large, with many doctors and nurses who may not have any respect for it. They'll argue theories, like the scientific theories, or argue that it's not grounded in theory, like in scientific theory. Or they may classify it as unsafe. So you're still dealing with people who have that, they call it a Eurocentric mindset, that this way is the best way and there is nothing else that could possibly be as good as our way, unless, and if it is, it has to be proven as good by our methods.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but traditional healing, it revolves around the person being in control of all of the aspects of their health.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So you're actually empowering the individual to take control of what they believe or what they feel is actually going to make them better with that. So it's a guided process, because, like I said, our traditional healing methods are highly spiritual in that regard. They're sort of like in a Western view, I guess, when you die, you die. Some people have a belief that there's an afterlife type of thing, but most of the indigenous belief systems is that there is another place, but you're not totally cut off from that place, and people are still able to help you and to visit you and be with you. And quite often we beseech those ancestors who have gone on before us to help in the process of healing, you see.
And, I mean, it's not any different from research in Western medicine, which, when people are labeled with any mental health type of condition, they start exhibiting the signs of that mental health condition, regardless of whether they have it or not. So, in my opinion, the whole, ancient teachings are so in keeping with Western medicine.
Yes, and even though in diagnosis, when you start diagnosing people and you start making classifications of which method is better, and like over that, if you have collected some of the various case studies around what we're finding, by and large, too, with many of the outside sources or organizations that are in charge with mental health programs with Aboriginal people, is that they don't have a good understanding of the historical facts of like colonization, oppression, even the privilege. So when we talk about systems such as privilege, then it gets very defensive out there. But when our Indigenous people are actually sent into those places, they're diagnosed based on methods which are researched, grounded research, I should say, within other populations or other cultural groups. And so quite often they're prescribed antipsychotic medications, both types of things. Right? And in some cases, sometimes it might help for a little while, sometimes it might be a detriment to the person. Different people who may have been diagnosed by a mental health person who's qualified, I guess, to provide diagnosis, come and see a traditional healer, and through conducting the ceremonies that they needed to conduct with that individual, and reconnecting them, I guess, to their cultural, social structures, connecting them to their spirituality, connecting them to the people, their family, friends, it doesn't take as long. So they don't have to make appointments for 5 to 10 years. Like with a mental health counselor, the help comes very quick, very quick. So this seems to be some of the stuff they always have to deal with out there, still behind closed doors. Yeah.
It sounds like an extremely diverse occupation that helps a lot of people.
Yes, it is. So they many of them come from backgrounds where they actually choose, or they would prefer to conduct many of the ceremonies with large groups of people in proper quarters, they would call it, in ceremonial houses, rather than within the walls of institutions such as hospitals or health centers. But they realize this is a very slow process for them and for some of our people. So this may be the coming to SOHAC anyways, or Southwest Ontario Aboriginal Health Act Center, quite often is one of the very first connections for Indigenous peoples to reconnect to who they are, because Canada does a very awful job in educating people on the true facts within history. So that's some of the stuff that we have to also correct within the belief systems and the mindsets of the people that come in through various workshops and presentations. We start off by telling them such things as the world did not begin in 1492, where history starts being told within the context of history, anyways, within public school systems. And there are many, many things that happened prior to that time. Many, many contributions that Indigenous peoples have made that have gone worldwide, including various theories which are used in psychological thought, things that people enjoy within recreation. You know, you have canoes, kayaks, you have rubber. There are many, many different types of things, including foods, medicines.
Well, it's very common, and I mean, Shannon Thunderberg, I think she says it best when she says that First Nations, Indigenous people are an integrated part of Canada's diversity, and I think that you've spoken it extremely well as well, that Canada is what it is, and you know, First Peoples are an important part of the culture of Canada.
So hopefully, there's still hope.
There's always hope as long as there's people breathing.
Yes, there is. Well, that's what most of our traditional healers do anyways, is, you know, like our traditional healers, unlike something different than Christianity, I suppose, they do not go around and try to convert people to their ideologies. That if you want to be Christian or Buddhist or whatever major religion that you come from, that major religion or belief system that you uphold helps you to live in loving kindness and to treat not only your brothers and sisters and all people in a loving kind way, but all of life and all of creation, then by all means carry it proudly. So this is what they teach.
Wonderful. It sounds like SOHAC is helping to eliminate the cultural erasure that's happening within First Peoples.
Yes, well, we try our best, and it's very difficult because we lack the resources. So there's only one of me, and so I'm in charge of two sites here. And between those two sites, we have to, I guess, go over and above and beyond to make the program such as traditional healing successful, because it doesn't have the same backing and funding as you would see a primary healthcare team. So what we have to do is, quite often I tell people or students or placements that come through the traditional healing program. So in this program, you have to be secretary. You have to be the great people. You have to wash dishes, do the laundry, and you have to go speak. And uphold and treat everybody with dignity and respect based on your teachings, you see. And that also means working odd hours. So you really need the backing also of your family, your family that you come from, in order to do that. So it's not a 9-to-5 or, you know, 8-to-4 job. It's defined by what needs to be done on a weekly basis.
I understand completely. So
we get kind of jealous when we see people with very large staff members who serve less than populations.
Oh yeah, the whole concept of a healthcare team.
Yeah. People look for the traditional healing team. I said, I am the traditional healing team. So, no, it's our traditional healers who do the majority of the work with the people, you see. So the coordination is, there's just a lot of background work that people don't see. And so that's the part that we're involved in. We don't want our traditional healers to come to SOHAC and have to do all that and plus do the work that they're gifted with. So we would rather them come in and be able to just work with the people and do the utilize their gifts, and then we take care of all the other.
Thank you very much for talking to me, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
And that was Doug George from SOHAC talking about the traditional medicine program there. I'm Michelle Boyce, and that's all for Between the Margins for today. Special thanks to Doug George, Laura Spiro from SOHAC for coming on, and Luke Nicholas, who was our first guest from Oneida First Nations, talking about the political climate and all of the other stuff that is very important that we need to get out there, as well as the celebration of this day. And so enjoy Aboriginal Solidarity Day, folks. It's been my pleasure to be your host for the past hour and a bit. If you want to catch other Between the Margins shows, then catch us at www.betweenthemargins.com, and there's blogs and everything on there. And have a healthy day.